Okay, folks, I think our attendee list has somewhat stabilized. We might have some late joiners, but that's okay. Let's kick off the webinar. So today we're going to be talking about incident response. The title is Under Fire, the Anatomy of Incident Response. So we've for some of you who have may have joined some of the Security First conferences that have happened over the last couple of months. We had one talk in Mauritius around this topic specifically, and it was very well received. So a very interesting topic, and to give us all some practical advice and some insight into how these things go down. It's good to know these before they happen in real life to you. So let me start off by introducing the panel who's going to be joining me today. If you guys can switch on your cameras, please. We've got Patrick Ragg, who heads up the incident response team at Integrity 360. So Patrick has quite a number of years doing incident response and focusing just on incident response in the EMEA APAC region. And he overlooks a team of seven or eight individuals that are just focused on incident response. And then we also got Chris on the call. And Chris is a solutions architect for Integrity 360. And he's going to be giving us his insights into this topic as well today. So, Patrick, Chris, thanks for joining the webinar today. Before we kick off, for just the folks that might not be familiar with Integrity 360, I'm just going to give us a quick overview of what the business does. So, I'm not going to bore you with sales stuff. You're fortunate that you have just techies on the call today. So, I'm going to have one slide about this, and then we'll move on to the topics at hand. This slide doesn't actually cover the fact that we do resell cybersecurity solutions from a number of, I would say, best of breed vendors. Besides that, we obviously have our professional services ranging from pen testing, consulting, PCI compliance, forensics. We obviously have a full suite of managed services. We have our MDR solutions that we have actually quite a few options in that space. So yeah, complete A to Z of cybersecurity solutions. And that's only, that's our focus, cybersecurity. We don't dabble in anything else. So we prefer to be experts at that. And leave the infrastructure and all the other stuff to others. So yeah, just a quick slide about the business, and then I'm going to hand over to Patrick for we're going to have a little bit of a draw at the end of this webinar. We're not going to do it live, just for the sake of time, but we'll be reaching out to a couple of individuals to offer this. I'll let Patrick talk to that.
Cheers, Martin. What we're offering is a gap analysis of your IR preparedness. So one of my IR analysts, so people with, sort of 10 plus years experience in handling major incidents, will do a gap analysis of your response plans, playbooks, roles and responsibilities, detection and escalation, tooling and logging, and third-party readiness. And then we'll produce you a report at the end. So yeah, just a lucky kind of lucky five people. As Martin said, I'm not going to name names in this call. I know some people might be anonymous anyway. Yeah, we just thought we'd try and give something back to the to you guys. So
And Patrick, that is kind of a slightly, I would call it a not a we offer this as a service, but this is a little bit of a watered down service just to give people a little bit of an overview of where they sit, yeah.
correct. Yeah. So we actually offer this as an add-on to our incident response retainers, in which case it's like a 5-day engagement. But in this case, It'll be a little bit watered down, but you'll still get the great benefit at the end. So.
Okay, great. All right, cool. So we can kick off now. I'm going to hand over to Chris. I know we've booked an hour for this, but we're hoping to get through it quicker because I know we're all busy this time of the year. So we'll hopefully finish before the hour, even with the questions. We've allowed a little bit of time for questions. Chris, over to you. Tell us what you've seen in 2026 so far.
Cool, thank you, Martin. What have we seen in 2026 so far, particularly in the South African and African context? So, a number of top five, I would say, exploits or breaches out there starts somewhere. And if you look at the first one, social engineering phishing. So, this is the number one threat in South Africa. In fact, it's estimated that 31% of all cyber incidents on the continent are phishing related. In SA, particularly, we see that 78% of digital banking fraud is phishing driven. So, phishing isn't just common; it's the backbone of most attacks. Is the message there? Exploiting public-facing applications. So, this is the growing attack surface. You know, rapid digitization in Africa have exposed more systems. Exploitation of apps, APIs, and edge services is accelerating. It's growing all the time. So as Africa digitizes fast, exposed applications are becoming the low-hanging fruit out there. Drive-by compromise. So this is the quiet enabler, really. It's less visible, but definitely growing. It's used mostly for credential theft and malware delivery. That's what we've seen. And then sometimes compromise starts with nothing more than browsing, and that's really where the drive-by compromise plays a big role. Then third party supply chain, this is the multiplier. So it's increasing the new use of using suppliers as an entry point. Attackers are targeting smaller suppliers to reach larger enterprises. We see that all too often. And there's a strong link to supply chain compromise to fraud and SaaS compromise. So in South Africa, many breaches don't start with you, the organization. They start with your suppliers. And then if you look at cloud misconfiguration, you know, we're looking at which is a new not a new it's you know, it's one of the ways if we have exposed cloud environments, we have workloads in the cloud, and we find that there's misconfiguration. Misconfiguration leads to risk, and sometimes misconfigurations are unknown to most of us in terms of our resource, our people that look after it. The misconfiguration only really comes to the fore once we're exposed. So we find that you know, beefing up on the configuration, making sure that best practices are always adhered to, is the best way to guard against those kinds of things. So, you know, when we step back and look at South Africa and the broader African landscape in 2026, the pattern is quite clear. The attacks have been driven by phishing. Number one, there's no doubt about that. Identity compromise, the new keys to the castle is the identity, and more by exposed systems and third-party access. So, but what does that look like inside a real organization? So if we move to the next slide, Martin, we can talk a bit about the victim biography. So let's introduce a typical example. So a company, we'll call it Umzansi Freight Group, headquartered in Johannesburg. So this is it's anonymized, but it is based on actual events that we've experienced with our customers out there in the world. So Umzansi Freight Group, they're a mid-sized organization, logistics company with about 3,200 employees. Their critical systems include supporting fleet tracking, warehouse management, and SAP finance operations. And from there, if you look at their security perspective, they certainly aren't immature, but at the same token, they're also not fully mature either. So no IR retainer, very important, no IR retainer in place. They've implemented MFA, but only on Office 365, so not across their VPN. Endpoint protection does exist, but it's inconsistent across the sites. And importantly, their backups are stored on a domain accessible NAS. So in other words, like many companies in South Africa, they've done some of the right things, but they still have gaps in exactly the areas where attackers are exploiting today. So you and Martin, oh sorry, Patrick will go through this in depth. So Patrick, please set the scene for us.
I actually just want to go back to the two slides before. Martin, do you mind if we just go back to the breach landscape? Sorry to screw things around a little bit, but I'd just like to go through some examples of these different incidents that we've actually dealt with in South Africa. Sorry, I didn't get a chance to jump in there. For example, in social engineering and phishing, we've recently had an incident regarding device code phishing. So device code phishing is where in Microsoft they send you a code or you request a code to register a device, and an attacker then gets you to basically enter their code in, and then it registers their device in Entra. We saw one of these incidents literally a week ago. On the exploitation of public-facing applications, we had a client that had a Mobile Iron. Mobile Iron is the old name. It's actually been bought out by Avanti, which led to the theft of phone details and then subsequently resulted in SIM swapping of a CEO's phone. Then, in terms of drive-by compromise, we had a victim served an ad for Trojanized PDF software, so basically a malicious ad, which then led to ransomware. And then for third-party supply chain, I'm sure everybody's heard of the recent NPM breach, the worm by Team PCP. We had an organization compromised by the TanStack variant, basically the mini Shai-Hulud worm, and then that led to their entire Azure environment being ransomed. And then finally, in cloud misconfiguration, we saw a large employee database exposed to the internet inadvertently. Sorry to jump around, but I just wanted to highlight that those are the kind of incidents that we're seeing in South Africa. So, Martin, I don't know if you want to just jump back to the case
Yeah,
in hand.
sure. Those are, like you said, those are kind of real things that we're seeing on the ground. I would say, phishing, we all know about public-facing applications. We know that there's vulnerabilities, a third party as well. Drive-by compromise is something interesting that we also see in the MDR service where, like you say, someone's just browsing and they have an exploit in their a vulnerability in their browser and it gets exploited and they don't even know it. So, yeah, very important for us to understand these.
And it reminds me of going back into the day. One of my first incidents I ever dealt with. I don't know if you guys have the Daily Mail in South Africa. You do? Okay. Oh God. Okay. Spread across the world. One of my first incidents I dealt with was there was a malicious ad served via a Daily Mail page. Because they're absolutely chocker with adverts everywhere, all over. And I remember. Reporting it to the Daily Mail saying, "Hey, you're serving malicious ads here," and I never got a response, and the ad stayed up for another week. So I don't think they really cared. That was a classic drive-by. There was a lot of questions at the time about how, just by visiting a website, can you get compromised? And the answer is yes,
Absolutely,
unfortunately.
yeah.
So let's get into this timeline then. So as Ms. Chris mentioned, this is a real incident that happened that we've dealt with. Obviously, the facts are slightly anonymized to not give away who this organization was. So this is a freight company in South Africa. So I've got a timeline here or a countdown per se, and it starts as such. So 14 days to go. The employee or an employee called the company's help desk stating that they had VPN issues. The help desk remoted onto their machine using the existing, I think it was Bomgar was the remote tool that they used. And then using their machine, they Googled their preferred VPN client, which I believe was FortiClient, and downloaded the first link that came up, basically. Unbeknownst to the help desk analyst, this was actually a malicious sponsored ad that's basically served them with a Trojanized VPN client. So, in all intents and purposes, the VPN client looked just like 40 FortiClient, you know, it had the icon, the name, absolutely everything. It even had a legitimate certificate on it, albeit not a Fortinet certificate, but it had a legitimate certificate signed onto it. And whereas in this case, instead of just being the VPN client, so it had all the, you know, standard VPN software in there, it had an additional DNL, a DLL in there, which harvested the credentials. So the indicators here are that a new executable was launched from a downloads folder. It had a certificate mismatch to the developer of the software. And then there were outbound HTTP post requests observed to an unknown domain. So 10 days to go, moving into 10 days to go, the stolen credentials for the VPN user appeared on an underground marketplace, which were then purchased by a ransomware affiliate. So for those that don't know, typically info stealers like this, they'll steal the information, steal the data, and then they'll sell those credentials on to an actual ransomware threat actor. So there's kind of a business deal going on. All of this took place outside of the victim's environment. So, and therefore there are no indicators at this stage. 5 days to go, the ransomware threat actor logged into the victim's network using the stolen VPN credentials, and then obviously appearing as the original employee. The indicators here being that there's a login from an unusual IP at an unusual time. I think it was about 2:30 in the morning, and then there was an alarm for impossible travel. So obviously attacker logged in from, I think it was Lithuania. Customer was in customer employee was in South Africa, so obviously that's a long distance. They couldn't travel in that kind of time. 3 days to go, malicious PowerShell scripts were deployed to create persistence in the form of scheduled tasks and services. So persistence is where the attacker wants to remain on the system, you know, after reboot or after, you know, basically just stay on the system. And then internal reconnaissance in the form of scanning for critical systems, such as files, servers, and domain controllers took place. And then the indicators at this stage are that the VPN session was generating internal scan traffic. So that's the reconnaissance, for example, a spike in LDAP requests. And then a standard user account was basically acting like an admin. So 1 day to go, getting closer to that detonation point. Privilege escalation in the form of stealing cached IT admin credentials took place, which then resulted in lateral movement via RDP. Sorry, I'm just moving my question Q&A. There's a question just come in there. I'm just going to move that box. A spike in L. Sorry, no. Privilege escalation in the form of stealing cached IT admin credentials took place, which then resulted in lateral movement via RDP to the victim's domain controller. The indicators here being that there was an admin log on from a non-admin workstation, and then RDP across regions as well. So that's a, you know, that's a big no-no. 1 hour to go is the pre-staging stage. So this is the basically getting ready for the ransomware, the deletion of shadow copies, NAS backups. As Chris mentioned earlier, the organization had backup stored on a local NAS connecting to the domain, and then the ransomware payload was deployed via GPO. And then the disabling of antivirus. The indicators there are kind of obvious, you know, backup system anomalies, GPO changes, endpoint protections disabled, you know, the disabling of antivirus. And then finally, you know, D-Day, destination, ransomware executes across the headquarters, regional sites, hitting VMware infrastructure, files encrypted, and the entire fleet tracking systems offline. So basically, the organization grinds to a halt. Indicators there, again, pretty obvious on this one, a ransom note and encryption extension for early identification of the threat actor.
So Patrick, if I may jump in there, if you look
Sure.
at this timeline, setting the scene for the timeline and what occurred before the actual attack, there are many points where there were telltale signs of malicious activity. What are the teaching points from this 14-day down to 1 hour? What are the teaching points here?
Sure. So at the 14-day point, obviously right at the beginning of the incident, the obvious one here is that the help desk should not have to Google their VPN client to download They should have it ready, internally. They shouldn't have to Google this. Then initial access and intrusion often happens outside corporate visibility. So in this case, the infection took place on one endpoint, and then the wider, the bigger attack happens later. So it's important to note that early indicators often manifest into bigger ones down the kill chain. A good way of defending is to look for those smaller indicators early on. Then with 10 days to go, you've got, I mean, info, I mean, obviously all of this activity and it with 10 days to go took place outside of the customer's environment. However, if the customer had a digital risk protection service, they may have seen the credentials being advertised on the underground marketplace. So DRPS services like that, they often look at, underground forums, Telegram chats, catch these sales going on in the background. Then with 5 days to go, the teaching points there are that the detection opportunity is high here. Because obviously you got the login from the unusual IP at the unusual time and impossible travel. However, these are often missed because creds are valid, and no malware is involved yet. So it's basically like it's just a log on. So they are often missed. 3 days to go. The identity misuse is a key signal there, so that should have been picked up. Again, no malware signatures at this stage because the vast majority of attacks these days use living off the land techniques. So in this case, they use PowerShell rather than malware to stay under the radar. So basically, living off the land is built-in tools, in the Microsoft or Linux stack that they can use, as opposed to the traditional, coming up with a custom remote access Trojan to do all the activity for them. Then with 1 day to go, they had a flat network in this case, so access to the critical systems was trivial. There should be segmentation between critical systems such as domain controllers and file servers and backups. Then with 1 hour to go, they had no immutable backups offsite, so that means that the backups were accessible. They were able the attacker could modify them, could delete them, and there were no kind of fail-safe endpoint protection. So the attacker with an admin account was able to just disable antivirus. And then finally, for the detonation piece, teaching points are that the attack chain started weeks earlier, outside of visibility. So all critical business work streams are linked to with no segmentation, meaning everything was here at once. So that, like the fleet tracking system was all part of the main domain. I don't know if you guys heard much about the Jaguar Land Rover breach last year in the UK, but part of their issue why it was such a big breach was because all the systems were interconnected. There was very little segmentation in them. So
Yeah, common problem that. Patrick, no data exfiltration on this one. That's normally quite common. Did you guys see that with this one as well, or not really?
Yeah, we did actually. We did see some data exfiltration. However, unfortunately, lack of logging meant that it was hard to d basically determine what was stolen. So.
We got a couple of questions, so if you guys have any questions, please pop it into there's a Q&A box on Zoom, and then we'll see how many we can get to at the end of the webinar. I'm going to move on to the next slide. Are you ready for that, Patrick?
Sure. Yep. I like the animation there. Thanks, Martin. So now I'm going to go through the IR process of the incident. So we've obviously had 14 days to go all the way down to the actual detonation of the ransomware. And then we've got they had an incident response engagement with us. They brought us in and we performed IR for them. So the first 8 hours of the incident. This is basically before we got involved. Multiple IR providers were requested for a quote, and this took several hours for the client to find one and get commercial signed. Obviously, it had to get signed by the CFO because it's not something that goes lightly. The third-party IR team was assembled in this time, so basically we got involved later on, like if, sort of 4 or 5 hours in. We created a war room. Communication grid and overall incident plan for the client. Then in hours 8 to 24, so moving on down the line, the containment strategy was created. So we basically issued our plan basically consisted of disabling VPN access globally, blocking all privileged access, sorry, all privileged accounts not in use, isolating affected subnets, and then shutting down non-essential servers. In parallel, we began the forensics. So this is the root cause analysis to determine the blast radius. So, is AD, is Active Directory compromised? Are backups impacted? Is data exfil confirmed? And so on. Then in days moving into the next, 24 hours plus, the forensics continued. The evidence of data exfil was found, and a notification to POPIA or POPIA in South Africa was and the public was made as well. So basically, we assisted the client with the notification to those two parties. Then in days 2 to 5, the initial access vector was found. It unfortunately took over 2 days to find patient zero because of severe lack of logging in the customer's environment. As a result of this, however, we were able to put together a detailed attack timeline reconstruction. So we're able to complete that piece of work. And then days 5 to 30, so moving on in the incident, recovery began with identity being first. So identities, user accounts being first, environment then cleaned as well. And then followed that by a phased service recovery. And then finally, in days 30 plus, going well past the incident, the rebuilding of mission critical systems due to lack of backups took place. So yeah, it was quite a drawn out incident, mostly due to lack of logging, but
Yeah, very comprehensive process, Patrick. You followed the processes to a T, and obviously there was an end result at the in mind. What can we take away from this IR process? What are the learnings or teachings from this process?
Sure. So in the initial 8 hours of the incident, I usually call these the golden hours because it's like all the pressure's on. There's usually information flying everywhere if you can't help it, and it's the most pertinent time of the incident to basically where a lot of things happen. And in terms of teaching points, I mentioned that the customer had to go out and get commercials. Before we even began the IR, we had to create a war room. We had to set up a communication grid and then come up with an incident or overall incident plan. So with an IR retainer purchase before, there is no need to do any of this. It's literally all set up. That's all part of the retainer is the onboarding process. And this would have saved at least 8 hours, the first 8 hours of the incident. And then moving into the 8 to 24 area. The teaching points here being that containment is about breaking attacker control, not just removing malware. And if an IR retainer was in place, then the IR team would already know the customer's infrastructure layout, including critical systems. And then for forensics, this stage is not about fixing systems. It's about understanding the scope and the attacker position within the network. In days 1 to 2, the teaching points there are that poor comms, with Popia and the customers and other third parties, reputational damage is often worse than technical damage. So it may take you a while to bring systems back up, but if the reputational damage is already done, then it's bad there. So. However, a good IR team will be able to provide legal and PR assistance with regulators and public notifications. They'll have templates ready, basically. And then regarding the data exfil piece, the IR team will be able to investigate what's stolen. So normally, threat actors release a proof pack, so 10 or 15 files, such as passports, files that they think will get your attention. The IR team will be able to download them and check that they are actually from your environment and where they've come from. So then in days 2 to 5, having an IR retainer in this case would mean that the IR team would know the customer inside and out, bring in the benefit of knowing exactly what logs the customer has beforehand. So They won't have to go searching for logs. They will already have access to those logs. And then days 30 to 5 to 30, a lot of companies focus on recovery from an endpoint point of view, but a lot don't have a quick and efficient way of regranting access to, say, 500 employees that have had their credentials reset. I see that quite a lot in incidents where, a plan has to be spun up on the fly, and the client starts bringing in, 500 employees into the office, which we know is really hard these days because a lot of people work from home, and there's no plan in place beforehand. So yeah, and identity recovery is just as important as endpoint recovery. And then finally, is it a kind of an obvious one there? Recovery was painful, slow, and expensive because of the lack of backups. Yeah, get immutable backups basically, because they are the number one protection against ransomware. So yeah.
Cool. Very interesting to see that.
Hmm.
And yeah, I think, Patrick, I mean, this is how most incidents are not, there's obviously differences, but this is kind of the status quo if customers are not as prepared as they should be, yeah.
Basically, yeah.
Cool. All right. So you spoke a little bit about the IR retainers. I think let's just focus on that a little bit. Just to close off on that incident.
Sure.
I think if we spoke about these breaches and how they unfold and how quickly they escalate if there isn't preparedness in place. So, let's talk about why we need an IR retainer. Why an incident response retainer really matters. And if you look at the screen, there are a number of benefits that we can talk about. But I'd like to ask Patrick, if you think about from an operational side, how does immediate access to experts, that high quality forensics and investigation, help us to not have to worry about the commercials in the moment? And how does that change so that immediate access to experts, the high quality forensics and investigation, not need to go through the commercials first, because that can be quite a time consumer. How does that re change how we respond during an incident? I think you've touched on quite a few of them, but if you could just,
Absolutely. So, having an IR retainer is like having an insurance policy. So you've got but it's an insurance policy that also includes the experts coming in. So it's not just we'll assist you with the incident. You'll actually get that expertise there as well. So a good IR retainer will have not just IR analysts as well. They will also be able to bring in other cyber disciplines as well. So, for example, firewall engineers, GDPR experts, PCI experts, and so on, other cyber disciplines that basically can help as part of the IR effort. And then no additional commercials would be required for those people. So, like that, it all needs to be seamless. So that's the commercial aspect of that is there. And then you've also got, obviously, you could bring in those experts from a, from an expertise point of view as well. So, but all of IR, pretty much the IR is by nature an emergency. So it's an emergency thing. So an incident happens, all hands on deck. You've got to get the business back up and running. Any preparation you can do, such as satisfying the commercials, having those experts ready, will save you valuable time and money. So, like, I can't stress that enough.
Absolutely. And then Martin, building on that, from a leadership perspective, how do you think preparedness and faster response translate into reducing the business impact? I mean, our C structure is all about how quickly can we get back to business as usual. So what are your thoughts
Yeah,
on that?
sure. I think Patrick said it correctly in that. Incident response is an emergency response, right? I always compare it to the fire department practicing to put out fires. And they train, they train on a regular basis. When they're not fighting a real fire, they're training. And that getting that muscle memory just allows you to react so much quicker. So it's really important. And that doesn't mean that an incident, if no matter how prepared you are, there's always going to be curveballs coming your way, but you're just able to deal with them better the more prepared you are. So that's really important point to get across to the leadership so that they understand the importance of having those practice sessions. You can't emphasize it enough. I've actually seen several companies do tabletop exercises where, it's not even a technical thing. It's purely going to executives and helping them understand what calls need to be made during an incident like this. Just going to an exec and saying, we have to shut down our online platform that is, our core of the business, selling online widgets. Either that or we risk losing more data, And, they ask questions like, well, can't we do this? Can't, and there's no answers, and they still need to make a decision. So, having some practice in dealing with that, and we've actually seen people have policies, like they're not going to pay ransom, so that it's clear definition in terms of how they engage in a scenario like this. So, yeah, the preparedness cannot be understated.
I think I like that analogy, Martin, of the fire brigade. I know in the corridors of Integrity 360, we often talk about that analogy of the very Formula One car. Patrick, you've spoken about this a few times, where all the controls we have within the vehicle, so the side view mirrors, the halo, and the brakes that can bring the car to a standstill quite quickly, those are all the usual things we put in place to protect ourselves. But the ambulance fire brigade is when things When bad things happen, that quick response and being ready to be able to tackle the situation is absolutely important, empirical, in fact. And that's really the point, right? It's about a retainer ensures that we're not starting from zero. So we're activating the a prepared and well and a very expert-led team. I think that covers quite a bit around why we need an IR retainer. So we want to go into the Q&A next, a new Q&A session next. But if we go to the screen right now, you'll see there's a session coming up that builds directly on what we've just spoke about. It's called "You're Looking in the Wrong Place: The Case for Application Layer Hunting." So this is all about it focuses on how attackers operate after initial access, and why many organizations miss that activity entirely. So if you're thinking about things like credential abuse, lateral movement, and so on and so forth, then you really want to take a look at this. So you can scan the QR code to register. For now, we'll leave it up, and then we'll go through it straight to a Q&A session.
Cool. Thanks, Chris. I'm actually going to leave this up so the folks can check that QR code. The next slide has just got Q&A on it, so it's not very interesting. We've got a bunch of questions. We're going to see if we can get through a lot of them. Okay, so this is an excellent one, and I'll often see this slowdown and confusion around this. Around this topic, the question is, how is misinformation or speculation handled during an incident? And I think that the conundrum there is you're expected to put out a statement to the public or to your customers or to your suppliers or whatever, but you don't have all the information. There's rumors floating around, and all that, you got to manage all that. Patrick, you want to weigh in on that one?
Yeah, so I've got a good example of this one. The Stryker breach, the organization called Stryker, they were allegedly breached by the Handala Group as part of the the Iran the US what do you call it, a war? Would you call it a war? So yeah, it's a war. In the early days of that breach, there was a Reddit post. On the popular messaging site Reddit, of multiple Stryker employees, basically saying, help, my laptop's locked down. What do I do? And there was internal information on that Reddit post being sent about Stryker and about the incident effort to the public. That is just ridiculous, really. So, that is a classic example of what not to do. From those employees' point of view, obviously, but it was clear that communications down from Stryker to the employees was difficult. So my recommendations are to control the narrative early, as early as possible, so to communicate communicate the breach, possible breach, what's happened, with instructions, and as frequent as possible as well, to even if there is no change. So basically just giving that reassurance that the company is on top of it and working on it. So you've got to separate facts from hypothesis as well. So if something is in speech confirmed, then you have to state that. If it's not confirmed, then state that as well. So state it's not confirmed, we cannot prove this at this point. Just separate the facts, because otherwise you'll get wide speculation that something is true. And then finally, actively monitor internal and external noise.
Yeah, I was just going to add there the the facts and the rumors, making sure you're clear on that. And also the frequent communication. If you look at any big organization that is, multinational that's been breached, and the ones that communicate clearly, frequently, there's almost I don't want to say they get a pass, but it's understood that they're the victims. And you've seen scenarios where you can see the organization's trying to cover up and be shady about some of the findings. That normally doesn't end well. So that's a good way to think about it. I'm going to jump into the next question. So there was a question about the economical impact of that incident. And that's always there's numbers and there's numbers and statistics, or there's a saying like that. But what was there a number that was disclosed, or was that left internal to the business, Patrick?
So the exact figure was not disclosed for obvious reasons, but we estimated it, and obviously internal chatter between the employees, to be about five million a day. So that's UK pounds. I don't know if you can convert that to rand off the top of
Lots of
your head.
zeros, lots of zeros on the back of that. So.
I work in pounds, so.
No, so always, you got to take everything into consideration: losses, reputational damage, and that can obviously add up quite a lot. When you look at pure bottom line, that might be a little bit of a different number, but yeah, for sure, that's the numbers are big
This
there in terms of impact.
org was a freight, it was a freight organization. So obviously everything was just in time. Like their whole business operating model was, it was just in time, constant real time, transit of lorries and logistics. So, any downtime is instant, like money loss basically. So it's not like
And
they could.
potentially canceling contracts with unhappy, customers. Right. So this question is around there's two questions around detection of this particular incident. Just a question in terms of how was the privilege escalation and the lateral movement was not picked up, and then what rules need to be in place to detect disabling of AV by GPL. Actually, I've seen that a few times as well. In terms of Microsoft Defender, the attackers just disable that. If I can weigh in on that, and then if anyone else wants to pick up on that as well. But yeah, there's always, we always talk about security being a multi-layered approach. And I think the slide showed that this customer had EDR, but it wasn't widely deployed. There are so many EDR bypass techniques nowadays that attackers can easily bypass EDR. You really need to spend a lot of time configuring these tools to lock down your environment. It's the days of just deploying AV and letting it do its thing is over. You got to continuously tune these tools to lock down your environment more and more. Same with the GPO and deploying things via GPO. Picking up that's kind of living off the land tools that Patrick was speaking about. Deploying a policy like that, it looks like any other GPO. You have to have a very specific policy in there to pick up disabling, because actually you're disabling software all the time, and enabling things. And the attackers love to use these living off the land tools because they fly below the radar. So you need kind of behavioral analysis, which is generally kind of noisy. So it is very tricky, but security is a multi-layered approach. You need to assume that your tools will be bypassed and you need something else to pick it up, even if it's further down the line. Chris, I don't know if you want to add, Patrick, I don't know if you guys want to add anything.
Yeah, I guess that talks to the technology people in process. So like you said, there's so many alerts that look very similar. Today, as a member of the team, I'm looking at logs. I see a log that suggests there's been a GPO change. I check it out and I see it's quite normal. It's expected. It was planned on investigation. Tomorrow, I see three more of those, four more of those, and next day, and so on and so forth. So with the technology people in process in place, we should build those gates. To know that this is an event, one single event, but what are the ramifications? What's happened elsewhere because of this particular change? And that's the kind of thing where we need to, we need to pull out all those resources together, the technology, people, and processes.
I got another interesting question, Patrick. I'll head this in your direction. When there's an incident happening and it's your incident kind of process and war rooms are called on, you know that there's a risk that valid credentials have been leaked. How do you ensure the integrity of the war room? And communications when you're doing these incidents.
Yeah, so that's a good question because I just want to throw an example in there, and this is obviously alleged; it's never been confirmed. But in the M&S breach, there was allegedly threat actors having controls of people's Teams accounts, and they were trying to access the war rooms. They were joining Teams calls to try and add pressure for the ransom and so on. So it's a really good question. So a good IR team or a good IR process in general from a company is to have a is to have a segmentation of communications. So some companies will have a separate chat tool, like they might use WhatsApp or Signal or I can't remember what the other one now, the one that Edward
Telegram.
Snowden, So basically them, and the, I'm not going to go into like which one's better or which one's more secure, but it's just about having another level of communications there. One idea is to have, challenge and response as well. So, before you start speaking to someone, issue a challenge and they respond with a known keyword or sentence, and you make sure those keywords and sentences are all kept offline, in paper or something, paper form, and then that's how you communicate. When we do incident response, when we do IR for an organization, we part of the service is standing up a war room, and when we invite the customer to that, they don't use their Active Directory, sorry, they don't use their Entra ID domain, they don't use their Google domain, anything like that. It's all hosted on our side. So the attacker has no way of accessing it. So it's all offline. So it is really important. So
Okay, folks, there's one other question which I'm going to talk about, but I'm not going to answer because we'll probably go over, even though we have 9 minutes left. I didn't want to go to the full hour, but the question is specifically around IR, AI, Mythos, and all the I want to call it noise in the news about how that is increasing the risks. So we're actually, I don't know if it's gone up yet, but we will be having a webinar specifically around that topic in the coming weeks. So definitely something that, and another topic that we can speak about quite extensively. So I'm not going to answer that question. But I think I'm going to leave it at that and wrap up. Thanks for everyone for attending. Chris, Patrick, thanks for taking us through the scenario. And thanks all the attendees for posting some great questions. We'll call it a day. And we have a lot of interesting webinars coming up, so you folks are welcome to go to the website, and you could scan that QR code, but also all those webinars are on our website. Have a good rest of the day, everyone.
thanks
Cheers.
all.
Thank you.
Cheers.